Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Archery's podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, first published in 1776, is a foundational work of political economy and one of the most influential books in the history of economics. Written as a broad inquiry into how societies become prosperous, it examines the sources of national wealth, the logic of market exchange, and the institutional conditions that support growth, rather than treating wealth as accumulated gold or state treasure. Smith argues that real prosperity comes from productive labor, specialization, trade, and the steady expansion of output. The book is also a critique of mercantilism, monopoly privilege, and heavy-handed commercial regulation. Its purpose is both analytical and reformist to explain how economies work and to show why freer exchange and limited government interference generally promote greater public prosperity. Because of this, the book remains central to discussions of capitalism, free markets, and the role of the state in economic life. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, national wealth comes from production, not hoarded treasure. Smith overturns the older mercantilist idea that a nation becomes rich by accumulating gold and silver. In his view, wealth should be understood as the annual flow of goods and services a society can produce and exchange. This shift matters because it moves the focus from storage to productivity. A country is not prosperous simply because it owns money or precious metals. It is prosperous when labor, capital, and trade generate real output that improves living standards. Smith's argument is more than a semantic correction. It creates a new way of judging economic policy, one that values growing productive capacity over state-led hoarding. That is why the book is often seen as a turning point in economic thought. It replaces a fixed-sum view of wealth with an expansive one in which economic growth depends on specialization, exchange, and the efficient use of resources. Secondly, the division of labor as the main engine of productivity. One of Smith's most important contributions is his analysis of the division of labor, famously illustrated by the pin factory example. His point is that when work is divided into smaller tasks and individuals specialize, output rises dramatically. Specialization improves dexterity, saves time lost in switching tasks, and encourages the invention of better tools and methods. The significance of this argument goes beyond factories. Smith is showing that productivity is a social process, not just an individual virtue. Economic growth emerges when people coordinate their efforts through roles, exchange, and mutual dependence. The division of labor also explains why markets expand as production becomes more specialized. Workers need broader exchange networks to obtain the goods they do not make themselves. At the same time, Smith recognizes a limitation that later readers sometimes miss. Excessive specialization can narrow a worker's abilities and make labor repetitive, which is why his analysis is both an endorsement of efficiency and a reminder that productivity has social costs. Thirdly, self-interest and the invisible hand as market coordination. Smith's idea of the invisible hand is not a mystical claim that markets always work perfectly. It is a general explanation of how individual decisions, when made in conditions of competition and exchange, can unintentionally support social welfare. People usually act from self-interest, but when prices, incentives, and competition are allowed to function, that self-interest can guide resources toward more valued uses. The result is not central planning, but decentralized coordination. This is one of the book's enduring insights because it explains how large economic systems can organize themselves without a single director. At the same time, Smith is not praising selfishness in a simple moral sense. He is analyzing how market institutions channel ordinary motives into productive outcomes. The idea is strongest when competition is real and barriers to entry are low, because then producers must serve consumers rather than depend on privilege. In this way, the invisible hand becomes a theory of coordination, not an excuse for unregulated power. Fourthly, a sustained critique of mercantilism, monopoly, and trade restrictions, a major part of The Wealth of Nations is Smith's attack on mercantilist policy, which treated trade as a competition for finite wealth and sought to protect domestic producers through tariffs, quotas, and export controls. Smith argues that such policies usually distort prices, reduce competition, and favor special interests over the public good. He is especially critical of monopolies and government-granted privileges because they allow producers to raise prices and weaken efficiency. This critique is one reason the book remains important in debates about regulation and protectionism. Smith does not claim that all government action is harmful. Instead, he insists that state power should not be captured by commercial interests or used to prop up unproductive advantages. His analysis is therefore not simply anti-government. It is anti-rent-seeking and anti-cronyism. The book shows that economic rules matter because they shape who gains from trade, whether markets remain open, and whether consumers benefit from lower prices and better goods. Lastly, the limited but necessary role of government in a market economy, although Smith is famous for defending free markets. The Wealth of Nations does not eliminate the state from economic life. He assigns government several essential functions, including defense, justice, and public works, that private actors would not adequately provide on their own. This is a crucial part of the book's balance. Markets can coordinate much of economic activity, but they still depend on legal order, property rights, and infrastructure. Smith's limited government view is therefore practical rather than ideological. He is concerned with what institutions are required for exchange to be productive and fair. Government should create the conditions for commerce, not micromanage it, or grant privileges to favored groups. That distinction helps explain the book's lasting influence. It offers not a vision of state absence, but a framework for deciding where public authority is justified and where it becomes economically harmful. In modern terms, Smith is asking how institutions can support competition without replacing it. In conclusion, The Wealth of Nations is essential for readers who want to understand the foundations of modern economics, the rise of capitalism, and the intellectual origins of free market policy. Economists, students of political theory, business leaders, historians, and policymakers will all find value in it, though for different reasons. For economists, it provides a classic explanation of productivity, specialization, and market coordination. For political readers, it offers a powerful critique of monopoly privilege, commercial favoritism, and overly restrictive trade policy. For managers and organizational thinkers, it still offers useful insight into how incentives and division of labor shape performance. What makes the book stand out among similar works is its combination of broad historical significance and direct conceptual clarity. It is not only a defense of markets. It is a systematic account of why wealth grows, how institutions affect exchange, and why prosperity depends on production rather than accumulation. Even when readers disagree with Smith's conclusions, the book remains unusually important because it shaped the vocabulary of modern economic debate and still frames many of the questions that economists ask today. If you would like to support Adam Smith, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.